Radio 1.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Business with Conor Brophy. You can contact us by text at 51551, by phone at 1850 715 150, email thebusiness@rte.ie or tweet at thebusinessrte. Now, our next guest this morning is a woman who was at the helm of Vogue in Australia for 13 years. That role gave her a unique insight into the cutthroat world beyond the catwalk. She's just published a book on her experiences called The Vogue Factor, and she joins us now. Kirsty Clements, tell us first of all, how did you end up in Vogue Australia?
Well, that was back in 1985, and I was looking through the classifieds at the time in the newspaper, and there was a little ad in the newspaper that said there was a job as a receptionist at Vogue. And I thought to myself, oh, imagine if you could get your foot in the door there. And I went and I was interviewed. I think I was the woman had interviewed 20 girls that day, and I was the last person interviewed, and I got the job. So I literally did start on the reception desk, and she'd asked me if I could use a switchboard, and I lied and said, yes, of course I can, because I thought, well, how hard can it be? And that's how it started. And then I stayed there for almost 27 years.
How closely does it ring to The Devil Wears Prada?
Apart from the scale of economy, pretty. I mean, you're only as good as your economy. And I think, you know, Australia's far, very far off that US powerhouse that Vogue is. But it did ring true. I think, you know, the idea, the way that ideas filter down, and that's sort of how cutthroat it was to a certain degree. I mean, there was some things that were not true, and especially if you compare it to our market, that you don't just go and help yourself to the clothes in the stockroom and things like that, you know. But to a degree, I think that there was a lot of real similarities.
You mentioned there the idea of things filtering down, or the way in which the fashion industry works. And there is that very memorable scene in the movie where Meryl Streep sort of deconstructs Anne Hathaway's thrift store wardrobe and tells her where the original ideas would have come from. Yes. One of the ideas, and you discuss it at quite length in the book, that is body image, and particularly the way in which models are treated in the industry. And you've spoken out about that since leaving Vogue.
Yeah, I mean, I think I didn't do it intentionally, to tell you the truth, Connor. When I was at Vogue, we put in a long time ago that we wouldn't use models that were under 16. I mean, that's kind of a no-brainer. I don't even see why you would need to use girls under 16 if you're dealing with adults. You know, you're selling a magazine to adults. And I guess I made my value judgments as the pictures crossed my desk if I thought a girl looked too thin. But I was a high fashion magazine editor, and there's a certain figure type that they want for the runway, which is very slender and very tall. It was only, I did hear, there was a couple of seasons in the 2000s where the girls got really thin, and I truly did hear this one story about models eating tissues. It was literally one line in my book, and of course it took off around the world, because I guess a Vogue editor hadn't spoken out and said, yes, I did hear this. I
mean, but you also describe, for example, the way that in-house models, those who would, the designers would use and would hang the clothes on, for want of a better phrase, when they're designing them, tended to be incredibly thin, and that it was disturbing that the idea that the very basis on which the clothes were being designed was to fit that sort of body type.
Yeah. And that's not news. Anybody can see that. If you watch any fashion documentary and you see the great creators behind the scenes pinning clothes or draping clothes on girls and creating their toiles, their girls are really super, super thin. So it's not that it's hidden. There's a dysmorphia, I think, in some of the echelons in the fashion world, where they actually can't see it after a while, and you do get inured to it. You know, when I was on the say I was on the road for 4 weeks doing all the shows, so New York, Milan, you know, London, Paris, by the time you got back to the baggage carousel in Sydney, you just thought the world was that thin, and then you got back and you were like, oh my god, this is what the world really looks like. So I think, you know, it is a very insider industry, the fashion industry, and they do get caught in a particular bubble. But you know, if you think about it, fashion designers often start with a sketch and their lines. You know, they're not really sketching a fuller figured woman on a page. They're line drawings. So it's a natural extension of that.
But some of the anecdotes, the eating tissue you mentioned there, girls on drips in hospitals so they could get Paris thin, being the phrase that comes through. If you could talk to us about that.
Yeah, well, as I said, that was what I was told that, but, and that is a true story. I didn't make it up to actually sell books, but I remember being horrified and thinking, you know, what are we doing? And as any editor would, and anybody, you know, anyone who's a mother and what have you. And so I was very mindful of that when we looked at photos, and I probably didn't think thinner was better. But what happens with the girls is that They lose weight. People tell them they look wonderful, so they lose more weight. Then it becomes this horrible trap where nobody says to them, okay, now you can stop. They just think if they get lose more weight, they'll get more jobs. Now, often the case is when they do lose weight, they do get more jobs. So, you know, how can you battle that? And I know I'd heard of house models being, you know, ill, and you know, people that were actually sample, you know, staying sample size, was that often they, it was incredibly unhealthy. So you had to judge, but you can't police what the girls eat. So it's very hard. And I don't even really believe in BMI, because it's different for every girl. And so unless you're really close to them, unless you are the family or the agent or whatever, it's very hard for someone who's booking somebody on a one-dimensional, for one-dimensional reasons, to actually know whether she's got an eating disorder or not. But yeah, the term Paris Thin was because I think the Australian girls are generally larger. You know, that I mean, I think that, you know, swimwear shows here and a lot of fashion shows here, the girls are actually probably they are a lot healthier looking. And if they wanted to work in Paris, if they wanted to do the Paris catwalks, they would have to drop two sizes. So, you know, we would say, well, so-and-so's gone, she's Paris Thin now, you know, because there's a different measurement there, for sure.
Since you left Vogue in May 2012, you've obviously had time to reflect on it. Do you feel, looking back, that you could have done more, that you should have done more yourself?
I think potentially yes, but the industry is very much controlled. It is a very closed industry, and an editor in Sydney is not going to really push the boundaries of what's happening in that very tight inner circle. You know, it's controlled by designers and a certain amount of stylists and a certain amount of influencers and tastemakers that are hugely powerful. But I think in our own way, I had a very strong deputy and associate that were not in the fashion office, and when pictures would cross our desk, we would actually look at them with another eye rather than just the fashion eye, which I think, as I said before, can get dysmorphic. So I like to think I made the judgment as the pictures crossed my path, and we did certainly put that thing in. We didn't want to have anybody under 16. I just think that's stupid when it's for the magazines for older women. And we just certainly, we didn't plug diets, but it's a glossy fashion magazine, so you could ask the same about an expensive moisturiser as well, you know. I mean, it's supposed to be a fantasy and a dream, and it's supposed to be fun, and you never want it to obviously get serious or to push people into eating disorders.
You left Vogue in May 2012, as I said, after 13 years as editor. It came to quite an abrupt end.
It did. So, yeah, that was very abrupt. For some reason, it's quite brutal in the fashion world, and particularly in fashion magazines. I don't know. I think it sort of looks like it's quite like, it, I don't know, it's funny to push someone off of what looks to be a very pampered pedestal. And I think there's a certain element of misogyny underneath it as well, that it looked like such an airhead job that it's kind of funny. It's strange. I mean, the media wash-up was odd. And yeah, just that's I don't know. It seems that none of them ever go of their own accord, doesn't it? So, but that's how it happened.
How did you react, though, if you're just sort of escorted to the door after 13 years at the helm?
Well, it's kind of vicious. I don't know what the press is like in Ireland, but the press is kind of vicious here in Australia. So you're kind of used to that. And News Corp own the license to Vogue here. So I think, luckily, the very next day I was offered a 3-book deal. And everybody was expecting a revenge book, but it's not a revenge.
Because there were reports, and you mentioned the viciousness of the media, there were reports in the Australian media, and I know you've denied this, that you threw a chair and declared grandly, but I am Vogue.
But I have no idea. You know, this is what people like to think.
It would have been a spectacular exit, though. I'm sure there's a part of you that wishes you had done that.
You know what is, I think the other way is to be so much more gracious on your way out. I think that's way more Vogue, to be gracious. And I know, just people make stuff up, you know. You read that Anna Wintour wears high heels when she plays tennis. It's just nonsense that people make up about Vogue. And, you know, I just decided that it's much better to hold your head high and be gracious. I think that's the way to behave. And so, you know, I was, of course, I'm the breadwinner, and it was my livelihood, and I love my job. But you get on with it, don't you?
You've seen a lot of changes, or you saw a lot of changes within the publishing industry. What's the future, do you think, of the likes of a prestige title like Vogue or Harper's, where I know you worked as well, or some of those other brands? Do they have a future as glossy magazines?
I think really mastheads have a future as long as you continue to put money into the product and you continue to make the product beautiful and relevant, and that you are delivering value to the reader. But I think when you start to cost cut and cut heads and panic, I think that that's a problem. I think in Australia, I keep coming back to Australia, but I think we're, you know, our markets, it is different, and we're so small, and we have a small population, and we're not particularly fashionable, well, to an extent, but we have a lot of magazines, so the competition is really strong, and so we're seeing the big hits that digital has given the magazine market. We're seeing them more quickly than the other markets, and I think there is a lot of panic and a lot of cost cutting, and ultimately that's what would kill a brand, as opposed to, I think if a brand stays strong, there'll be always a place for them.
What's the relationship between the magazine publishers and commercial interests? That must mix and mingle quite a lot, because obviously there's a codependency, but clearly there's a lot of money at stake.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen over the years that, you know, that they never operated completely separately, but now they are one, and I think some questionable decisions come because, in fact, you can't. Most editors I'm talking about here, but most editors cannot push back against the advertising dollar at all anymore. It's a give, you don't even question it, and I think that that's starting to reflect in products as well. And I mean, that's what was so funny when the bloggers started, and the advertisers would say, "We're going to put some of our money with bloggers because they've got an independent point of view," and you'd be like, "Excuse me, you've been putting so much pressure on us for such a long time." But I actually do think ultimately integrity wins, because you've got to keep the connection with the reader. The reader's got to believe what you say, and you can only redraw the line in the sand so many times and till you absolutely sell out. So that's an ongoing problem.
Kirsty Clements, thanks very much for speaking to us.
Thanks, Connor.